Well, ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the Globalization Debate 2003. This is now an annual event in the school's calendar. It is, I am told, a long-standing LSE tradition. It dates back to the dim days of the last century. In fact, as far back as 1999. It has always been an extremely popular event, as tonight's audience demonstrates. And I think that is partly because globalization remains such a matter of concern to many people, but also because the issues change very rapidly. And indeed, in preparing my brief introduction for the debate this evening, I cheated and did what speakers hate you to do, which is to look back at what they said before. And in fact, I look back to the debate in 2000. And I won't identify what individuals said at the time, but then all the speakers in the 2000 debate were agreed that interstate wars had become quite improbable. Though they could, if pressed, just about imagine the possibility of a long-distance air war fought with high-technology weapons. Clearly, that is a conclusion which now needs rethinking. There was also, in 2000, a belief that international regulation would and could be strengthened to cope with growing internationalization and the power of transnational corporations. That seemed like not an unrealistic assumption at that time. Since then, of course, and very recently, we've seen that the WTO process has come to a halt, at least temporarily, and in financial regulation, where I've spent the last few years, it has become much more difficult to reach international agreements. Indeed, some of the international agreements we do have on banking regulation are in the process of being unstitched, and the US in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act has gone off on its own, producing effectively transnational extraterritorial regulation with no agreement from anyone else at all. So there are some assumptions that lay behind some of the points of view taken in this debate that now need reworking. To some, globalization remains essentially an optimistic creed. To others, the dangers are more apparent than the benefits. Also, in preparation for this debate this weekend, I read a new book by Robert Cooper called The Breaking of Nations, Order and Chaos in the 21st Century. Cooper, as some of you will know, was a special advisor to Tony Blair. There seem to be rather a lot of ex-advisors to Tony Blair at the moment. But he is now the Director General of External and Political and Military Affairs for the European Union Council. And his new book, which is, I think, published in the next week or two, begins, "The worst times in European history were in the 14th century, during and after the Hundred Years' War, in the 17th century, at the time of the 30 Years' War, and in the first half of the 20th century. The 21st century might be worse than any of these." Now, to guide us through the gloom, or to show us the path to the sunlit uplands, we have not just a global, but a stellar panel for you this evening. And I shall just introduce them briefly to you in the order in which they're going to speak. First, we have David Held, who is on the far left. Whether that's true in anything other than the physical sense, we will discover, who is the Graham Wallace Professor of Political Science, here based in the government department at the LSE. He's held numerous visiting appointments in the US, Canada, and Spain, among other places, and he founded 15 years ago Polity, which is now a major presence in social science and humanities publishing. And as my notes go on to say, for more information, click here. Secondly, we will have Nitin Desai, who is on the inside right position here, who is a visiting fellow here at the school at the Center for the Study of Global Governance, and until very recently, was United Nations Undersecretary General for Economic and Social Affairs. and indeed remains a special advisor to the Secretary General. The third will be Mary Caldor. I don't need to tell you where she's positioned on the stage, who's Professor in Global Governance at the LSE and co-director of the Centre for the Study of Global Governance. She has published very widely, and her recent publications include Global Civil Society 2003, which is pictured above me. And then last, but by no means least, we will have John Clark, who's worked in development for over 25 years, specialising in bridging the gap between grassroots organisations and official and government agencies. Was in the World Bank for 6 years from 1992 as manager of the NGO and civil societies unit. And then he led social development, he was the lead social development specialist in Asia, looking at the Asian economic crisis and looking at new ways of partnership working between the World Bank and other agencies in the region. Now, I will not intervene further in the four speeches, which will follow one after another. Indeed, my role tonight is merely as a referee. I am the Pier Luigi Collina of globalization, even to the extent of the haircut. But the rules of this are very simple. There will be four speeches. They will not last more than 10 minutes. David has asked for 12. I'm not sure I shall grant him that, only if he's interesting. And then after they have spoken, we will have perhaps a brief moment for them to question or comment on what each other has said, but then it will be over to you. But the rules are clear that they make speeches and you ask questions. Of course, you may introduce a question extremely briefly, but anyone who seeks to make a 10-minute speech from the floor will... I don't think we can physically cart people out, but we have ways of marking your exam results down if that kind of thing happens. So that's what's going to happen, and we undertake to wind up by 7:30 at the latest, in which case, without more ado, David Held.
Well, thank you very much, and good evening to you all. Two very preliminary remarks based on what Howard has already said. One is in the social sciences, some people think the social sciences can and should be modelled on the natural sciences, and that the social sciences are predictive disciplines. I don't take that view, and some of your introductory remarks are good testimony as to why I don't. But Hegel made a very wise statement in the Philosophy of Right. He said, "The owl of Minerva flies at dusk. Wisdom comes with hindsight." And in some senses, that's the position we are all in. The second thing I want to say is that it's very important in social science not to overgeneralize from the present. These are gloomy and somewhat dark times in geopolitics and the international environment, where some people are very quick to draw deeply pessimistic conclusions about what is possible. But in the social sciences, we don't overgeneralize from one short time period, we don't overgeneralize from one short experience, and we don't overgeneralize from the basis of one country. And I think it's just worth taking these broad little maxims seriously to create a wider historical context. Well, having blown 30 seconds or more, let me just say a few things about globalization and then get to my main topic, inequality. For me, globalization describes the expanding scale, growing magnitude, speeding up, and deepening impact of transcontinental flows and patterns of social interaction. It refers to a shift in the scale of human organization that links distant communities and expands the reach of power relations across the world's regions. But it shouldn't be mistaken, perhaps obviously enough, for prefiguring the emergence of a harmonious world society or process of social integration. Globalization, as we all know, is contested. It's fought over both in academia, we'll have a bit of that later, and more broadly on the streets, from Seattle to Geneva, Rio to Tokyo. And one of the reasons for this lies in the very poignant aspects of the history of globalization. Peoples in different cultures and regions have different historical experiences of globalization and different historical memories. It needs to be emphasized that there's nothing new about globalization per se. There have been many phases of it over the last two millennia, including the development and spread of world religions that makes pop culture look very ephemeral indeed, the age of discovery, and the spread of empires. We can't run train service anymore, but it's useful to remember that from this part of the world, Britain controlled a vast empire. As European countries exploded onto the world over 500 years ago, linking parts of it together which had previously been isolated, they brought with them not just technologies and economic techniques, look what we have to offer you, come and share it, but also, of course, new forms of political oppression. We like your country, we'll keep it. These early forms of globalization generated experience and memories of not just the opportunities posed by a growing interconnected world, but for many peoples, it marks the dangers and risks. Now, while many researchers don't agree upon the substantive processes of globalization, that's to say how to characterize them, there is some measure of agreement about what globalization doesn't involve. And let me just rattle off a few points by way of context. I think it's reasonable to say globalization does not mean Americanization. It refers to such changes as the growth of modern communication systems, the emergence of a world trading system, the development of international law, global environmental shifts. The USA is a key driver, but it's not been the only driver. Secondly, it's often said that globalization leads to a race to the bottom in welfare, labor, and environmental standards. But the fact is that the distributive consequences of globalization are much more complex than this suggests. Thirdly, it's sometimes said that globalization is associated with or engenders the end of the nation state. I think that's wrong. Political power is being reshaped and reconfigured, but not simply with the decline of the state, but rather as a result of the fast growth of world cities, subnational regions, supranational regions, NAFTA, EU, Pacific Asia, and, of course, new forms of global governance, WTO, the IMF, the World Bank. Blair faces a complex array of political forces, both below, alongside, and as it were, above. Fourthly, globalization simply doesn't compound global inequities. I shall come back to this, but briefly, while the average incomes in the world's wealthiest and poorest countries are now further apart than they've ever been, the proportion of those who live in the very poorest conditions, that's living on less than a dollar a day, appears to be declining. I'll come back to that. Fifthly, developing countries as a whole are not losing out in world trade. Important to remember, over the past decade, developing countries have consistently outperformed developed countries in terms of export growth, enjoying an average increase of almost 10% a year compared to 5% for the industrialized countries. Sixth, despite what the IMF and World Bank have generally demanded, the rapid removal of all free trade barriers and capital movements does not appear to be the best route for all countries to economic prosperity. The West didn't develop like that. Most of the successful countries in Pacific Asia didn't develop like that. So as a general bland prescription, it's not just misleading, it can be dangerous. Finally, economic globalization and the current structure of international organizations do not just undermine the voice and leverage of developing countries. The economics and politics of globalization is more fluid. Now, having said all that by way of general background and a number of propositions with which you can take issue later, I want to say just a few minutes, dwell for a few minutes on global inequality, which I take to be one of the crucial challenges to the legitimacy of the contemporary project of economic globalization. The debate about global inequality is complex, and the debate about its causes and consequences is complex. The principal division is between those who understand global inequality as the inevitable product of two centuries of industrialization in the West, and who interpret globalization as a powerful force for spreading wealth and reducing poverty, and those who argue it's doing exactly the opposite, creating a more impoverished and unequal world. Well, there's some truth to both positions, and there's something wrong with both positions. Now, it's very hard to get a grip on what is happening to global poverty and inequality, because in many parts of the world, data is patchy: India, China, and large parts of Africa. But as far as I can tell, five things are going on simultaneously. Firstly, the absolute gap between the world's richest and poorest states is now at historic levels and accelerating. Secondly, the proportion of the world's population living in absolute poverty, as I mentioned earlier, appears to be declining. Thirdly, there are rapidly diverging patterns of life chances between men and women. As Kofi Annan put it, today inequality often has a female face. 70% of the 1.2 billion people living on less than a dollar a day are, for example, women. Fourthly, just as there's social mobility within countries, there's social mobility between regions and between countries. Inequality shifts between regions and countries over time. And fifthly, within-country inequality has increased since the 1980s in several countries, for example, Asia, China, in China, Thailand, Malaysia, Latin America, Chile, Colombia, Mexico, but it remained constant elsewhere. Now, the key point I take from these complex findings is that while globalization can in principle be enormously beneficial for economic development, growth, and the extent of individual life chances, it isn't necessarily so. Despite what our chair has said by way of introduction, it seems to me unless globalization is carefully managed and regulated, it will not be so. In my judgment, it's no good, in fact, it's quite bad, being tough in pursuit of free trade, tough in favor of capital market liberalization, and tough in favor of the deregulation of all markets and liberal politics, i.e., just pursuing the Washington consensus. By contrast, we need to be tough in pursuit of free markets while insisting upon a framework of shared values and common institutional practices, i.e., balancing open markets with strong governance, social protection for the most vulnerable, and some elements of distributive justice at the global level. If globalization is to work for all, we need to regulate. We need to calibrate the freeing of markets with poverty reduction programs and the immediate protection of the vulnerable, north, south, east, and west. Now, in my remaining minute or two, if that's all I said, it wouldn't be enough. But let me just create an imagination for some of the issues involved, a list. What does this require? In my view, it's not beyond our imagination, and it's within our policy grasp. Well, first of all, despite the failures at Cancun, we need to make sure that the next trade round is a development round that brings serious benefits to the world's poorest countries. This is contested and fought over, but I take the emerging coalition between Brazil, China, India, and other developing countries as a positive first step. Second, we need to ensure that TRIPS is compatible with public health and welfare. Cancun is potentially promising there, but we don't yet know the details. Thirdly, we need to recognize that for many developing countries, phasing in their integration into global markets is far more important than insisting on free trade and capital market liberalization straight away. We need to build on organizations like the WT Advisory Center to expand the capacity of developing countries to engage productively in the institutions of governance of the world economy. We need to set a clear timetable for governments to reach the UN 0.7% GNP overseas aid target and raise it to 1% in due course. It's pitiful that so few countries reach this level. We need to untie aid budgets. We need to further reduce international debt of the most heavily industrialized countries. Despite the work in this area, the progress so far has been very limited. And finally, three final thoughts. We need to improve cooperation among international financial institutions and other international donors, consolidating the policy-making efforts of the international community within the UN. We need to open up financial institutions to developing countries that are grossly underrepresented in many of them, for example, the Financial Stability Forum, where there's no representation and little on the Basel committees. And we need to institute a review of the Bretton Woods institutions created more than 50 years ago, and now we're operating in an economic context that has drastically changed. All this seems to me, in principle, within our grasp. It seems clear and empirically supported. What is striking to me, by way of conclusion, is that we haven't yet done any of these things.
David, thank you very much. We do have a clapometer, actually. We were hoping for at least 19 standing ovations in that one. But let me go straight on to Nitin.
Thank you. Firstly, may I say it's a pleasure for me to be back in London School of Economics after about 40 years. This building in which we are was the Royalty Theatre in my days, and it specialized in rather off-color entertainment, Raymond's Review Bar, if I remember right. But I'm afraid we don't have anything quite as exciting to offer you. Professor Held is a political scientist, and he has focused his attention very much on the economic agenda, of which we need to address if we want globalization to work. It's in the very nature of things that, being an economist, I shall focus my attention a little bit more on the political agenda that we need to address. And that's partly because of the fact that I've been working in the UN, and that's what we've been most concerned with. All of us are very familiar with the globalization of trade and finance, the dismantling of trade and financial barriers, which have led to this great expansion in international trade, financial flows, technology. I'm not going to focus a great deal of attention right now on this, but as I see it, this aspect of globalization is really something which reflects the interests of transnational capital. In many ways, I could argue that transnational capital is both a cause and a consequence of this process of liberalization, privatization, and dismantling of trade and finance barriers that we call globalization of trade and finance. But that's not the only globalization which is taking place. There is another globalization in which the United Nations, as a United Nations, has been much more involved. And that's the globalization of values and norms. And that's what I want to focus attention on now. Much of it has happened because of the political space which was created in the United Nations for this purpose. And it takes a variety of forms. It's a thick consensus in many ways. It's not just a statement of broad principles. It also involves elaborate programs of action and many other activities to try and implement these programs. First, as a consensus, it involves a set of values and norms on how governments are expected to behave towards their own citizens. I do believe the Universal Declaration on Human Rights will be remembered long after everything else that we do in the UN is forgotten. That declaration, the covenants which came out of it, the various things that have been done in the United Nations for women's rights, for children's rights, for the disabled, etc., falls into this category of a certain consensus on how governments are expected to behave towards their own citizens. Second, I believe we have a certain agreement, a thick consensus on how governments are expected to behave with one another. In fact, the UN Charter is precisely that, a statement of the obligations of each government in its behavior with other governments. And I also believe that over these years, the UN has developed a third very important area, the area I have been a little more involved in, which is the obligations of this generation to future generations, what we broadly put under sustainable development. This globalization is a very different thing from the globalization of trade and finance. This globalization has taken place because of the growing density of people-to-people contacts, because of travel, because of migration, because of mass media, the internet, and the emergence of citizens' networks, what Mericaldo would call global civil society. And I would argue that this globalization is intimately linked with them in the sense that global civil society is both the cause and the consequence of this globalization. It has contributed to it, but it itself has been engendered by this very process. And I think between the two of these, between the globalization of engendered by transnational capital in trade and finance, between the globalization which was engendered by global civil society of values and norms, I think there's a certain transnational sensibility which is emerging. It is obviously there in the people who are involved in global civil society or transnational trade and finance activities. But I also see this in the UN, in national governments. More and more what I see is that a finance minister, I won't say worries as much about what his peers in other countries are going to think of him as what his cabinet colleagues are going to think of him. So also an environment minister or a labor minister. It's a type of transnational network of approbation, framework of reference, which does play a certain role in securing consensus. This is where we are. But the fact is, it's not working for all of the reasons that Professor Held described, the inequalities, the growing protests not just from academia and the protesters in the streets, increasingly the protests that we see inside the negotiating rooms, also from governments and diplomats. And I think it's important we understand what these problems are more clearly. Clearly, we have a problem on the values and norms, on the enforceability of these values and norms. We have them, but we do not have effective mechanisms for enforcing them. Most recently in Iraq, what happened was not consistent with the UN Charter. But that's not the first time that we've had interventions taking place outside the framework of the Charter. They have happened, but perhaps none with this type of global range and impact that this one has had. And there are many other areas that one can point to the fact that the violation of these norms goes gets away. We have no mechanism other than naming and shaming. And because we are diplomats, we name with such great politeness that the shame does not take place. We have to address that particular issue. Much more important, we need to address the fact that the globalization of trade and finance is not just incomplete, it is partial in both senses of the term. So for instance, we've had this great liberalization of trade in the products of great interest to the richer countries. But we've left agriculture and textiles alone, products of interest to poorer countries, poorer people. Or we've had many norms on the free movement of capital, or even a capital to go out there and establish itself to provide a service. But we do not have that when it comes to the movement of natural persons to provide a service, a matter of great importance when services are playing so great a role in global trade. We had a situation recently where a group of software engineers from India who were providing a software service in a European country and were promptly imprisoned because it was said that their business visas did not entitle them to provide that service. It is discriminatory because if a person from Europe has to provide a service in the US, that person from Europe does not face the same visa restrictions as a person from India or Philippines. Why? It is incomplete, it is partial. And unless we address the partiality of this globalization of trade and finance, then what you are going to see is a revolt in the negotiating room as you got in Cancun. Professor Held is absolutely right. What happened there in terms of the common cause made by the powerful developing countries was a very important forward step in the global politics of globalization. But we will have to address this if we want globalization to proceed. Third, the agendas of the two globalization must come together. We cannot talk of saying we are interested in doing something about HIV/AIDS when we have an AIDS special session and give ourselves great goals, and then hold back what needs to be done in terms of modifying the TRIPS agreement in order to deliver medicines where they are needed. If you had a situation in your country where 40 to 50% of the people were infected, 25% of the children were going to become orphans, where the expectation of life was going to fall from 65 to 40, maybe even lower in the case of Botswana, it could go to as low as 27. Would you let intellectual property rights stand in the way of people accessing medicines? No. But that's exactly what we have allowed ourselves to do at the global level. Yes, we look as if we are going to solve this problem now, but it took us unconscionably long to do it, and millions have died because of that. These two agendas, the agenda of norms and values and the agenda of multilateral rules on trade and finance, must be brought together if we are to be credible. I think all of this reflects a certain fundamental weakness. We do not have the political institutions which can reflect these concerns as well as the new geometries of power. We still live within a structure of institutions which reflects the geometry of power as it existed in the mid-40s, which does not recognize the growing importance of global civil society, of transnational capital. And we are trying to take decisions within the framework of institutions whose political structure no longer reflects the reality of power which out there. And the most important challenge for me, therefore, is the political reform of international institutions, a call which has been basically made by the Secretary General in his speech to the General Assembly just a few weeks ago. I will not try and elaborate this. Maybe some of the questions, some of the things may come, but I do believe political legitimacy will not come without this. But in the end, what we need also is a cosmopolitan sensibility. We cannot proceed to operate these institutions entirely from the perspective of national interest. We need to be able to look beyond our national interest, beyond our history, at other people's histories, other people's cultures. That's what cosmopolitanism is. And in some ways, I would argue that you find many more people who are cosmopolitan in this sense in the third world than you do in other parts of the world. So if I may end, I would say that maybe what you really need is many more white Indians and maybe fewer brown Englishmen. And maybe this is the place we get. Thank you very much.
I'm not sure that more white Indians would do a lot for your cricket team, but we'll see. Mary.
Well, the picture that you can see up there is actually a picture of people in Antarctica who were demonstrating on February the 15th against the war in Iraq. And that, for me, is globalization. Indeed, on that day, on February the 15th, some 15 million people demonstrated worldwide. This was a popular mobilization that was unprecedented in history. And what I really want to stress today is that globalization is not an abstract process. It's not, we tend to think of it as something inexorably going on that we have to react to. It's not simply the invention of internet, air travel, interconnectedness. It's actually something that's the outcome of deliberate agency by individuals and groups. Usually we think of globalization as something to do with big corporations. Well, they're certainly part of it. They are certainly agents of globalization. But it's also something all kinds of people do. It's something students do. Probably here in this room, we have the most global student body in the world. And people come from all over the world. You're part of globalization. It's something migrants do. It's something religious groups do when they cross borders. And also, as Nitin Desai was emphasizing, it's something groups, individuals, social movements do, what we call global civil society. Now, 4 years ago, as Howard Davis has pointed out, when we began these debates, we were very optimistic about globalization. We were, of course, aware of the inequalities and insecurities of globalization, but we did believe that this process was going to bring great benefits to the majority of people. And we thought it was a matter of strengthening multilateral institutions so as to guarantee human rights and to bring about social justice. I think in the aftermath of the Cold War, we were very optimistic that this would happen. We saw these norms and values that Nitin Desai described developing, and we thought that a global consensus was developing, a cosmopolitan consensus, if you like, around these issues. Now, I think since then, everything's changed, and I think what we've observed, even before September the 11th, is the spread of what some of us have started to call regressive globalization. And let me explain what that means. What I mean is the spread of global developments designed to benefit the few rather than the many, designed to benefit particular groups rather than humanity. Mm. This is, in an obvious way, this is happening in the economic field. Nitin Desai talked about how trade and capital benefits the rich and doesn't benefit the poor. We don't have globalization of people. We don't have free trade in agriculture and textiles. But I think there were two other developments in the political field challenging those norms and values that Nitin Desai was talking about. On the one hand, we have the development of what we might call global unilateralism. What we see in the current American administration is not isolationism or rejectionism, or even, I would say, imperialism. It is global unilateralism. It's using global power in the American national interest, or at least in the interests, the American national interests as perceived by the Bush administration. And on the other hand, what we also have is the spread and growth of nationalist and religious militant networks who are interested in furthering the interests of particular groups, whether it's a religious group like Islam or Hinduism or the Christian right or a national group. And what really is worrying is that both what happened on September the 11th and Bush's war on terror, especially in its most recent phase against Iraq, I think have dealt a major blow to the optimism that we felt a few years ago, to the sense that the world really can be reformed, to the prospects for reform of international institutions. And that's, in a way, what I want to talk about. Let me just interject one point here. Howard Davis said we all agreed a few years ago that interstate war was improbable. I think what we meant by that, or at least I did, was symmetrical war between states as we've experienced in the 20th century. And I think that what we're seeing now is actually asymmetric war. Whether it's war by the United States against weaker opponents, or whether it's war or violence by terrorists against civilians, that's the characteristic of violence and war at this moment. And even in the case of Iraq, I think the Americans certainly would claim that this was not an interstate war, it was an anti-regime war, not an anti-state war. Maybe ordinary Iraqis would not agree with this, but nevertheless, that's what the Americans would claim. What I want to focus on here is these new nationalist and religious movements and what they mean for us and why we have to think about them and deal with them. Many people might want to underestimate the effect of what the Americans like to call global terrorism. I don't think we should underestimate them. I think we should try to understand what's happening so as to find alternative mechanisms for dealing with them. So I want to say a few things about these elements of regressive globalization, and then I want to return to the prospects for the future. Now, the first thing I want to say is that I think the growth of these movements is very much a reaction to globalization. They're not throwbacks to the past. They aren't movements that have somehow been kept quiescent during the Cold War years. They're very much reactions to globalization. Why are they reactions to globalization? Well, I think they emerge out of the inequalities, insecurities that is characteristic of globalization. Very typical recruits to many of these movements are migrants. Either people who have moved from countryside to towns, who are the new vast urbanized class, or people who've moved from one part of the world to another, who have broken away from their traditional homes and their traditional ways of life, and yet somehow are not integrated into the new society. So they're typically the recruits to these new movements. Also, unemployed young men, frustrated, often unable to marry because they don't have enough income, often unable to finish their education, affected by cuts in public services, cuts in employment, cuts in education. So that's one thing I want to say, is something about the ways in which this is a reaction to globalization. These are movements we're talking about that are political. They're political in that the movements want either to capture state power or to create new states, small states if you like, or maybe big states like a Muslim caliphate in the Middle East. They're backward-looking. They tend to look back to a past which is often completely imagined, where things did work in a pure, unpolluted, unglobalized way. And they believe very much, and this is absolutely central in the notion of a struggle, that they are engaged in a struggle against another, whether that other is crusaders and Jews, as in the case of Al-Qaeda, Hindus, Muslims, or whether it's other nationalities, as in the former Yugoslavia. Now, these are groups that if you like, construct their ideologies. They spread their ideas, first of all, through the new media. They make use of globalization through the new media, through the use of video cassettes, through the internet, through satellite television. That's how they create global networks. But also through violence itself. And I think this is a terribly important point to understand. Violence is very often key for many of these groups, violence against civilians, because it's through violence that you actually create the sense of struggle that you're engaged in. It is through violence that fear and hatred are generated, which provide the basis for recruitment to extremist movements. I always quote this, but I remember very well someone in Bosnia saying to me, this war had to be so bloody because we didn't hate each other before. We had to learn to hate each other. So this is violence, this is asymmetric, this is violence where the main victims are civilian. And very often there are deliberate efforts to create more civilian victims. You may remember last week the Palestinian suicide bomber, the woman who created such havoc, added nails to her bombs in order to be sure of killing yet more civilians. And these are movements where the organization also owes a lot to globalization. They're networks of small cells which depend very much on modern communications. One of the reasons why the FBI, with all its money, with all its efforts, all its intelligence, has had such trouble dealing with Al-Qaeda is because many of the cells are self-sufficient, and they multiply. These are organizations which receive funding both from criminal sources and from their diaspora elements, from people abroad in places like America, Canada, Australia. And I think a very interesting feature of these organizations is that they often create parallel societies. They create NGOs who offer social services for newly arrived migrants when state social services aren't available. They create schools where their brands of ideology are taught, and these are often in areas where state education is inadequate. So the madrasas in Pakistan, a whole new wave of Hindu schools in India. Now, my main point, one of the reasons I'm telling you all this, is because I think the Bush administration's approach of creating a war on terror simply reinforces these movements. I think we've seen over the last year that the war on terror has not prevented the bombings in Riyadh, the bombings in Casablanca, in Bali, and in a whole range of places. I think it feeds the notion of struggle. It actually provides publicity. The destructiveness in a war like that in Iraq actually creates a framework of criminalization, which provides a source of funding. But having said all that, I feel it's not enough simply to say we're anti the war on terror. We have to be able to offer an alternative way of dealing with it. We have to be able to offer a constructive alternative. We have to reach out to Islamic groups or to other kinds of groups. We have to cross divides to unemployed young men. We have to deal with their frustration. We have to do something about schools. We have to do something about social services. Above all, we have to deal with the black holes, the conflict zones, or the authoritarian regimes where these kinds of movements flourish. It's not easy. I don't want to claim that there's some perfect panacea. We live in a very risky world and a risky society, but I think there are ways in which one can behave differently. Now let me return to finish to the demonstrations on February the 15th. I think what was important about them was that they brought together the anti-globalization movement, people campaigning about social justice, together with Islamic activists. They opposed the war, but they didn't actually offer an alternative. They didn't propose how one might topple authoritarian regimes like Saddam Hussein. And they didn't actually come up with very many constructive solutions on the economic front. They were anti-globalization, many of them, rather than for progressive reform. And my fear is, I'm not saying this is everybody, But without a real progressive constructive program, we face a real risk of polarization, of reducing the political space for reform. I think we have two scenarios for the future. Of course, we've got many more, but let's say two extreme scenarios. One scenario is the dominance of what one might of the regressives, these people I've described, whether you're talking about Bush or whether you're talking about nationalist movements, who reinforce each other, and the rejectionists, those people who say down with globalization. And that's going to be an anarchic, criminalized, violent, terroristic world. The other is that more space is created for a reforming agenda. We provide support for civil society in Iraq, but we really try to cross the divide and try to offer an alternative that can, for example, convince American public opinion that their war on terror isn't working, that makes use of the fact that democracy in America still exists, and that there should be ways of achieving not just regime change in Iraq, but regime change in the United States as well. And I'll end on that point.
Well, it's a, thank you, Mary. It's a sterling attempt to correct the obvious grotesque inequality of there being 30 minutes allowed for men and 10 minutes for women here. But you've redressed some of that balance. John Clark.
Thank you. First, I want to say that I agree with virtually everything the previous speakers have said, so I hope they don't criticise me. Secondly, I wanted to say that introducing me, our chairman focused just on my World Bank experience, but actually most of my career has been in civil society organisations, 12 years with NGOs, a couple of years here at the Centre for Civil Society, and I've also yet another former advisor to Tony Blair on Africa.
It's confession time.
And currently I'm working with the UN Secretary General as a project director of a panel he's established on UN civil society relations. So with all that, my presentation is about civil society, and I'm going to talk about five ways in which I see it becoming increasingly important in shaping the course of globalization. I'm not saying that civil society is the only factor in global change, but heck, I've only got 10 minutes. Firstly, I think we'll see more nuanced messages and stronger disagreements within civil society as the most powerful groups realise that they really can influence policy. They will increasingly expose the hypocrisy of the neoconservatives, emphasising that the world isn't moving towards one globalised marketplace, but in fact towards a patchwork of many markets, as Nitin said, different markets for commodities, capital, high-tech products, IT services, unskilled labour, corporate managers, intellectual property rights, and so on. Some of these markets becoming global, whereas others aren't, and indeed may becoming more restricted. And this favours the powerful countries and companies who dominate the opening markets and squeezes the opportunities for countries and people who depend on the protected markets. The civil society organisations will campaign energetically about egregious agricultural policies of northern countries that spend $300 billion a year protecting their farmers, six times more than aid. It's simply wrong that each EU cow receives $2 per day in subsidy, which is more than most people in the developing world have to live on. It's wrong also that each US cotton farmer gets on average $3,000 of subsidy per week. It would be cheaper to house them in luxury villas in the Bahamas than do that, and it would be a hell of a lot fairer for the third world farmers in the Sahel region of Africa who are reduced to selling their cotton below the cost that it takes them to produce it. Such campaigns will increasingly assert reform, the need for reform agendas in northern agricultural policies, fair opportunities for southern textile and clothing workers, less restrictions on labour mobility, and so on. Interestingly, these so-called anti-globalisers will paradoxically morph into the true pro-globalisation movement and will expose the protectionist neoconservatives as the true anti-globalisers. Secondly, the more analytical NGOs will deride another hypocrisy, that poor countries who are quickest to open their markets are fastest to catch up with the North. But in reality, the rapid growers like India, China, Vietnam often have very interventionist governments. They're anything but textbook liberalizers. Moreover, faster growth isn't the same as catching up. Faster growth means that the economies are accelerating faster, not necessarily that they're catching up. It's like saying that the bicycle that sets off to catch up a racing car that is at full cruising speed is catching up. For the first few seconds, it's actually accelerating faster than the car. Of course, it's not catching up. East Asia is the fastest growing region, and it would need to maintain its current rate of growth or acceleration for 74 years before it catches up with the industrialized world. And for the first 50 years of that, the absolute wealth gap between them and the North would continue to rise. Thirdly, civil society will, I think, put increasing emphasis on the political aspects of globalization, not just economic. The democracy deficits that are becoming increasingly evident, in particular, the deficiency of reach. Today, traditional institutions of democracy hold decreasing sway over decisions affecting everyday life, because these are increasingly made in global forums, regional blocs, intergovernmental forums such as the WTO or IMF, and in global corporations. Such forums may be accountable to some governments for some things, but they don't regularly come under the purview of national parliaments, as would major decisions in the national sphere. And of course, there are no supranational parliaments to fill the void. In short, though economics has become globalized, politics hasn't. Just as nature abhors a vacuum, citizens abhor an absence of accountability in public life. Hence, there are increasingly backing NGOs and others whose global networks challenge intergovernmental organizations and processes. The impotence of familiar democratic mechanisms in these areas is one reason why people, the young in particular, are turning away from the electoral processes. They are increasingly concerned with issues like the environment that are long-term and global, while they see elected representatives concerned, consumed by matters that are short-term and parochial. We have widespread declining voter turnout, an even steeper decline of political party membership in much of the world. In many rich countries, party membership has shriveled to between one half and one fifth of the 1960s level. And this isn't just citizens' apathy. People are joining causes that they believe in. In the UK, as an example, more people now belong to the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds than all political parties together. As we evolve from delegative democracy, which is the periodic selection of delegates to represent the constituencies we live in across the spectrum of political matters, to deliberative democracy, more direct engagement in the particular policy debates that interest us through joining pressure groups, our political congregation in the 21st century is becoming by communities of interest more than communities of locality. Fourthly, I think, however, that we'll see an increasingly strong civil society movement bent on modernizing delegative democracy rather than supplanting it. This is important because powerful advocacy NGOs often face a backlash from establishment critics and are indeed skating often on thin ice. NGOs represent their own interests, their own views, not public opinion. They aren't elected. Their accountability mechanisms are often weak. Now, we might thirst for a world parliament and see it as a 21st century need. Well, maybe it'll become a 23rd century reality. But for now, we need to make national parliaments and legislators more relevant to global issues, a topic that the UN panel I serve is exploring. One way might be to establish global forums that formally connect those select or standing committees of national parliaments that deal with issues that really need to be taken up at the global level today, such as the environment, health, agriculture. Fifthly, I think we'll see a new phenomenon of like-minded groups, coalitions of countries, that's nothing new, but working closely with the more influential NGOs. Having attended myself the WTO ministerial in Cancun, this for me was the most promising sign. I don't myself, as some, celebrate the breakdown of those trade talks. for all the flaws in the WTO and in multilateral trade regimes, of one thing I'm sure, what will be worse for developing countries than multilateralism is serial bilateralism. The ray of hope at Cancun for me was the emerging group of developing countries led by Brazil, China and India that stood up against the G7. Not only the confidence in their newfound solidarity, but its qualitatively new partnership with some of the leading NGO networks there, my old organisation Oxfam, ICTSD, a coalition of NGOs on trade and others. The NGOs provided information useful for the negotiations, their media activities publicised the group's cause, and their advocacy reinforced its stance. There were shifting numbers of countries aligned with this group. So it was referred to variously as the G20, the G21, the G22, even the G23. I actually hope that they settle for G21, not actually because of the number of countries, but because of the hope that it signals for new global justice in the 21st century. There are other examples of government NGO coalition building on issues. We've seen it with debt, landmines, the International Criminal Court, and climate change. Just last week, Oxfam, Amnesty, and others launched a campaign backed by a group of African countries calling for strict international controls on the small arms trade. In conclusion, the future holds immense opportunities for civil society. It's becoming more influential, and it's driving change in the leadership of large institutions, public and private. Of course, the future will be frustrating. Institutions resist change and activists are impatient. What I think is most important is that the values espoused by global justice campaigners and also some of their ways of working become embedded in intergovernmental organisations and in the modernising of the institutions of democracy. This is what I call for in Worlds Apart, my new book on this field, for a campaign for ethical globalisation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Now, given that on a number of issues our panel are in violent agreement, I'm going to go, and given also the time, I'm going to go straight to the floor. What I'm going to do is to take a number of comments and questions, because if we just have one and then all four respond, we will have very little time, and then I will farm them out amongst the panel afterwards. It would be helpful if you give your name so that people can refer to their questions in giving the answers. And it'd be also helpful if you could mention whether or not you've been an advisor to Tony Blair and whether you're a member of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. But otherwise, feel free. I think I saw, a hand.
I'm still, despite what...
Name, please, sorry.
Mr. Hamer, sorry.
Thank you.
Despite what the panel have said, I'm still slightly unclear as to what we're talking about when we refer to globalisation. Some of the panel have made reference to millennia-old traditions of exchange and international interaction. Can I just propose perhaps a slightly narrower definition? It seems to me that the great economic policy initiative, international policy initiative of my lifetime has been the decision to progressively remove all restrictions, legal and administrative, to the movement of goods and capital. Okay, so that if we're talking about globalization, it is that the effects of that initiative that we have to assess. Or there may be wider meanings to globalization, but could we just focus on that, if the panel would accept that as a worthwhile starting point?
Can we have a question?
Oh, now, first question, first of all...
Just one.
I was going to be much more brief, but could the panel perhaps tell us why we needed to do that? What was the benefit to that? Because there would seem to be a number of obvious disbenefits. In the pre-globalisation era, as I define it, I'm going to be very brief, I can see you. The ownership of capital was associated with the acceptance of obligations, and those obligations were enforced by political and political jurisdictions. Now, if we have completely free movement of capital, how are those obligations to be enforced?
Okay.
Some of the panel have suggested. Hang on, just a minute.
No. I'm really sorry. You have exceeded my tolerance. Could we go back four rows and then in? Thank you. Man in white shirt with hand up. That's it.
Good evening. This is a question...
Name?
Jay Shah. This is a question directed to Mr. Desai. I do agree, obviously, globalization of trade and finance is incomplete. And as Mr. Professor Held said, that we need to put development back on the agenda. One of the problems I have is that it seems that majority of world trade is at present on the side of the developed countries, obviously. And developing countries, it is a matter of survival. And it seems for developed countries, it's really a matter of surpassing their previous GDP rate or in such instances. What I want to know is, how can this partiality be addressed? How can we give greater representation to developing countries? And I mean, are we simply waiting for a change of administration in the US? How can this be addressed? Because it seems to me that on the negotiating table at Cancun, the US have the greatest power, and it seems as Europe and Japan simply want to follow what the US has been doing. So I want to know, how can we progress in the next world trade talks?
Thank you. Now, there was another one just about four rows in front. Red arm.
Hello, my name is Karen Cairns. I'm an MSc in Development Studies here at the LSE. For Mr. Clark and Professor Kaldor regarding global civil society. I attended the UN NGO DPI conference earlier this year, and which is a wonderful conference that's held once a year, and the UN opens its doors to many civil society organizations from all over the world. And one of the main themes that you know continued to crop up in the workshops and in some of the sessions was this issue of, well, first the issue of the North-South relationship in civil society. You've got a lot of initiatives driven by very large NGOs that are based in the North who are doing work in the South, and then you have a number of Southern civil society organizations who are working on their own smaller sort of local initiatives. And so one of the issues was how to sort of build relationships between sort of large northern NGOs and smaller southern civil society organizations. But another theme that cropped up continually was a concern on the part of southern civil society organizations about the sort of good and bad civil society, particularly in certain regions in the South and in Africa in particular, where funding and support from the North was going to a number of... Oh, I'm sorry. Well, my question is, how do we address those issues of, you know, northern support and technical assistance going to what many perceive as the wrong civil society organizations and feeding corruption in the South rather than going to some of the smaller organizations who are less well-funded and all that.
Thank you. I had to cut you off because Mr. Haidman was catching my eye and I was being discriminatory there. Right over on the far right wing.
Tara Poulter. My question is based on the violent agreement on the panel. Whenever too many eminent persons agree on something as big and complicated and political as globalization, I find it very worrying because it comes across as if there were a sensible, well-informed, progressive perspective and then everybody else is not sensible, partial, and not well-informed. So my question is, in this debate and today in the global political arena, are there still well-founded differences of political opinion? I think left and right have been superseded in many ways, but is there a new spectrum? Is there some way in which the panel would say people they respect and people they feel are thoughtful and people they feel are basing their information and their thoughts on an analysis of what's going on, that they nonetheless differ in terms of the values they want to see coming out of this and the ways in which they see that being achieved?
Thanks. Really interesting question. One directly behind you, actually. Just give the... That's it.
My name is Preeti, and considering, presuming that global civil society is trying to bridge gaps between the developed and the developing countries, why do we see a lot of generalizations being thrown at the developing countries, like rise of fundamentalism and stuff like that? And we never hear a mention of problems like, say, racism and gun control and rising crime rates in developed countries? I mean, isn't that regressive globalization as well? So that's my question.
Thank you. Can I just go into the center block? And there was a woman just one row in front of you, again, in a red shirt. I'm discriminating in favor of red shirts. I can see them.
Linda Corsha. I've heard women mentioned twice this evening. Once the usual thing about 70% of the poorest people in the world are women, which is a huge thing, but usually it's just left at that. And the other one that only one of the speakers on the stage is a woman, and that's pretty usual too. So some of us actually notice these things. I've heard the word engendered spoken twice this evening as well. Well, some of us actually have another meaning for the word engendered as well. And my question is, why don't we hear more about really engendering global governance? For instance, from people on stages making speeches about globalization and global governance.
Thank you. And then about three rows in front and right in the middle, this time a black shirt.
Jonathan Ezer. I disagree with David Held that the suggestions that he made are within our policy grasp. I'd like to ask the panel, you've made a lot of great suggestions, but do you really think they're realistic in this current political climate? Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I'm going to take a couple more. White shirt directly behind the microphone at the moment, and then I'll take a yellow one. Let's do.
Thank you. My name is Khan, and I'm from Pakistan. And sitting here, I can feel that we are talking about globalization and everything. It sounds nice. But in my country, I feel that there are so many economic disparities that we don't have, we can't really think of these sort of things. Like in a big city and a smaller town from where this Professor Mary talked about these religious schools and all that. It's because of these economic disparities that these guys who go for jihad and all that stuff. My question is that this globalization in this West sense of the word is that these are spending a lot of money on defense and other their corporate interests. Why can't we spend anything on education and health in poor countries? I mean, 70% of the budget of Pakistan goes to this defense purposes. For whatever reason, I'm not going into that. But only 1% or 2% goes for this health and education. I mean, sitting here, I can feel that there's something should be done about it. Thank you.
Take one last point down here.
Thank you, new chair. Davis or Harvard Davis, I'm not sure about.
What's your name?
Question is to both the panelists. Okay. Despite the appointment of this courageous Muslim woman, Shireen, by the Nobel Committee, we all think the third world that the international organizations like US or IMF or WTO are misrepresented or overrepresented by not ordinary white men, the allied white men. So until otherwise this issues are addressed, the trade barriers will compete with the new Berlin Wall created, built by the Israel, and the European cows will get more care than the Botswanian women or child dying from HIV, and the third world professionals will be spending, rather than working in the Western world, we will be spending our time in your detention center. So we want eminent persons are everywhere. As the word rightly said about discrimination by John Clark or Nitin Desai, that we ordinary people from with the extraordinary talents from the poor country should be positively discriminated to the world organization, then we will get the globalization. Our next step should be that headhunting for the right person. Here, the David Hull and Mary Calder, you should motivate people to go for world chambers, madam. Thank you, and best wishes for your new chairman.
Thank you very much. Now, the panel has a difficult job because there have been 10 questions. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start with John and move across. And I hope that you'll pick up the ones that were particularly addressed to you. And any really difficult ones that haven't been addressed, David will deal with. Mm-hmm. John, the one that particularly was for you was about, from Ms. Karras, I think, on NGOs and the North-South ones. I thought it was particularly interesting. If you could pick that up particularly, but then also comment on any others you wish to.
Good, yes, thank you. Well, I agree with the point, and I agree with her enthusiasm for the DPI NGO conference. I was also there. I think there are two parts to the redressing the North-South imbalance within the NGO playing field. Part of it is capacity building in the South, and that's very important in NGOs, but also the UN, I think, has a role to play in helping southern civil society to move more freely in the international arena and to engage in the policy, the deliberative processes globally. But I think there's another point, which is the capacity of the UN and other organisations to reach out to the South. I mean, I think part of it is that we need to change the way in which there is international deliberative processes or international policy discussions. So it's based much more at the country level, and that the global builds on the country level. So it's a sort of bottom-up approach to global policy making. I think the second point she made about the good versus bad NGOs or civil society organisations, that's very real, but of course we'll never solve that. And civil society is a sector like the private sector. The private sector contains good firms and bad firms, the pornographers and the, you know, highly ethical corporations. So civil society will be the same. I think the important thing is building up expertise within organisations that need to work with civil society that helps them to identify which ones actually do have sizable constituencies, important experience, are ethical, and so on. Giving a chance then to comment on a couple of the other points. The first question about what do we mean by globalisation, I actually thought that David had answered that in his opening remark, and I think that at its most neutral level, globalization is about reducing the barriers to exchange and transactions between people across national frontiers. Part of that is technical, the information age, reduced costs of travel, the spread of English as a normal means of international communications and so on. And part of it is political, policy changes that reduce barriers and that sort of thing. In a way, I think what we were all trying to get away from in this panel was the focus on globalization only meaning capital markets. And indeed, when you focus on all the attention is on liberalizing the capital markets, you get to precisely the inequalities that we were all talking about, that one market is globalized and everything else remains progressively frozen. So that is what drives inequalities. Just very briefly on the point about the equal opportunities, I think that the points about gender, of course, are right. The points about North-South, of course, are very important. In the World Bank, I helped to set up the external gender advisory group after the Beijing summit, or the Women's Summit. Within our panel, I'm pleased to say that we've got a 50-50 balance between men and women, and we've also got only 3 people from OECD countries and 10 from developing countries. So I think there's a bit of balance there. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Nitin. Let me take up the question about how can the partiality, Jayesh asked this question, about how can the partiality in trade be addressed? How was it addressed in Cancun? You know what happened? What was the typical tactic in trade negotiations? I was involved in the Uruguay round. What happens is the United States, Europe, don't keep blaming the United States. Europe is as much responsible as the United States is. And Japan and Canada, which stay very quiet, are also responsible also. Please, let's not forget that. Now, what happens? What's a typical tactic? There'll be a crisis. Europe and US fall out. Then there will be these negotiations between them. They will work out a compromise. And then they will come to the developing countries. Says, look, this is an extremely delicate compromise. We cannot touch it. If you want what we are promising you, take it or leave it. And it usually comes at the last minute. This is what happened in the Uruguay round. Then there's always something which they would be put in there to split the developing countries. Somebody says, oh, let's accept what we can get. And then it goes through. This time, this didn't work. Precisely the same tactic was tried on the last day. Europe came out with a compromise proposal which tried to split the interests of Brazil from the others, and Brazil said, no, this is not what we want. And in the final analysis, Cancun broke down, not just because of Brazil, India, China, and South Africa. It broke down because the poor African countries simply said no. That's what we have to do. simply say no, so that the political institutions have to change over time, to hear the voices of these people who have been compelled to take agreements which are negotiated amongst the so-called Quad countries as given. And I think this is going to happen in Cancun, and this is part of a process of change. It's going to cause a few eggs will break here and there, but that's what's going to happen. Can I just address the question of are there different agendas? There are. This is the problem. I would say there are at least four different ways that people at the country level are looking at the global, particularly governments, and that is our problem in the UN. First, we of course have the reality of the US's immense power. It is, in military, economic, and political terms, it far exceeds anything else. But remember this, the US was even more preponderantly powerful in 1945. The degree to which its power was greater than anybody else's in 45 was far greater than today. Then they chose to go in for the multilateral route because they had seen the weakness of the unilateral route during the 30s and 40s. This time, they seem to be more tempted by the unilateral route because what they see as the perceived weakness of multilateral processes in the areas of interest to them, and we should understand that. That's one agenda. The second agenda, which I describe as a European agenda, is an agenda which is transposing the European experience, that the only way to peace is by a democratization, rule of law, and human rights. That is a European experience, and in a sense, they are trying to transpose this to a global level, and that is an agenda. The third global agenda that is being pursued, I would associate very much with the large, rapidly growing developing countries, an agenda which focuses largely on the multilateralization of trade and finance, the parts which give it. And the fourth agenda, which is also an interventionist agenda, I mark you, is the agenda of the poor countries who want concessions in terms of aid, trade, etc., from the richer countries because they're losing out in this process. And remember, that is an interventionist agenda. You're telling a rich country this is what your domestic policy ought to be. These are four competing agendas. And our problem is we can't get them to merge. And when I was speaking of the new geometries of power, this was part of what I had in mind. So I just thought I would just say that please don't think that there is a consensus out there. That isn't a consensus on the politics of globalization. And that is what we have to aim for.
Thank you very much, Nitin. Now, you're lucky, Mary, that Nitin picked up that question, because otherwise I was going to ask you to articulate a defense of the common agricultural policy. But you may pick up other points.
Well, let me start just with the question, is it realistic? I think there was a difference of opinion above us, between us. And I think actually, at least I meant to be, I was more pessimistic than everybody else. And the reason I'm pessimistic is precisely because I think a world characterized by violence and fear is a world where progressive forces are very beleaguered. And this is my concern about the present conjuncture. That relates to the question of differences of opinion. I actually thought that was exactly what I was talking about. I was trying to say there are regressive globalizers as well as progressive globalizers. There are people who reject globalization, there are people who want globalization in one direction, people who want, and there's an argument going around. And global civil society doesn't just consist of the nice people, it consists of a whole range of opinions. And by the way, I didn't by any means want to suggest that fundamentalism is a third world problem. On the contrary, the Christian right, the anti-immigrationists, and what is more, most of these networks I'm talking about are funded by groups in the United States, in Canada, in Australia, who don't feel at home there. So you simply cannot talk about fundamentalism as a third world phenomenon, although I would be prepared to say that the victims are mostly in the developing countries. Then I wanted to say something about NGOs. I don't think NGOs are the same thing as civil society. And indeed, my friend or colleague, Mamdani, a Ugandan who teaches at Columbia, has this wonderful phrase, NGOs are killing civil society. For me, civil society is about the ways in which individuals are able to express their views in the public arena. And how they do that is in a myriad of ways, on demonstrations in the third world, on in churches, in universities, and NGOs are only one small part. In fact, I'm not even sure how far you can say their part, because they're not always autonomous of governments, since they're often funded by governments. I think there is a real problem that in the global arena, those NGOs do get to appear as representatives of civil society, and I think ways have to be found to overcome that problem. Finally, women. I'm sorry that I didn't mention women, because I feel very, very strongly that women have a key role in overcoming many of the divides that I've described in every conflict zone that I go to, and I do often visit conflict zones. I always find a women's movement that is crossing those conflict divides, and I think women shouldn't be. Very often people pay lip service to women in international arena. It's not a matter of lip service. Women's movements are a real instrument in the kind of progressive global governance that we're talking about.
Thank you. David, you have the last word.
Let me start and end very, very, and be very brief. Let me start by agreeing entirely with Mary's last point. I think everywhere you go, the role of women's movements are utterly transformative. But if this is to turn into an economic agenda that has substance, then dominant IGOs and INGOs need to pay more attention to some critical issues like reproductive rights, like education for women around the world, and by focusing economic development strategies more on women. I think, to come back to a question I said I was unrealistic, I think we do know a little bit about how to do that, although I'm not going to dwell on that now. Let me just make a few final points about optimism, pessimism, and so on. Well, in response to the first question, is globalization really about capital markets and nothing else? I agree entirely with the panel on this issue. That is mistaken. Of course, the neoliberal project of economic globalization has been immensely influential in the last 30 years. But if that was all globalization was, many of us would not have said the things we've said this evening. Globalization has also been about the strengthening of international law, the human rights regime, the creation of an international criminal court, about the attempt to reframe human activity in universal rights and norms. And these are very fundamental shifts, which haven't come from nowhere. They've come from the debacle of the Holocaust. They've come from the debacle of the Second World War. And slowly over time, developments have been initiated which still have fundamental significance. Now today, it does seem to me that we're at a crossroads. Either we withdraw from some of those achievements, or we build on some of those achievements. And I'm with Mary on this critical issue. At the moment, it seems to me, some of the most dangerous developments have been initiated not just by religious and fundamentalist groups, but by the current change of regime in the United States with the doctrine of preemptive war. What has it resulted in? What is Afghanistan today? It's Kabul. What is Iraq today? It's a financial hole, and it's increasingly a situation on the ground that is out of control. One of the great lessons, it seems to me, of the failure of the coalitions, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, is that there is no durable alternative to international law, international legitimacy, multilateral institutions. And I take Iraq and Afghanistan as demonstrable evidence of that, rather than the other way around. So I hope very much that the politics of the next few years go reasonably well, we draw the lessons of this, and we will look back at the current short period, the last 2 to 3 years, as an aberration where the achievements of 1945 multilateral world were briefly turned against, but the lessons of that brief turning against were that the single-minded pursuit of state interests, the single-minded unilateral use of force, in the end, compounded the problems of peace and stability in the world and did not create a more durable settlement. On that ground, I think the way from and away from the Hobbesian war of all against all, the kind of anarchic picture that Mary Caldor has been warning us about, is to go back to the 45 settlement and rebuild it, rebuild and strengthen international legitimacy, international law, multilateral institutions, and those are our only collaborative ways forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much, David. And I am not going to attempt, another summing up, so I thought that would be hard to better. So all I will do is thank, first of all, on your behalf, the panel for some stimulating introductions, and secondly, on the panel's behalf, thank you for some extremely good comments and questions. There will be more of this to debate as we go through the year, and the globalization debate in this community is not just a once-a-year event. It's with us all the time. But there are many other events, and my last task is just to draw your attention, particularly if you're a new member of the school community, to the events booklet, which includes lots of other exciting things just like this. Thank you for coming, and have a good evening.